You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician. And this time I have again Kaspar Rufibach on the line, which is really great because we are talking about an issue that is not very much taught at university, because it is really something that hits us pretty much every day in our work environment, because in the kind of textbook versions of statistics, we hardly ever talk about this. And that is the interpretation of statistical hypotheses, confidence intervals, p-values, and so on. Welcome, Kaspar. So you have been stepping over that problem. Where is that coming from?
Welcome, Alexander, or thanks for having me on the podcast again. I think there are two sources where I stumble upon over this. One is, of course, the discussion that's going on for a couple of years with the American Statistical Association issuing some recommendations, kind of basically saying we should not use p-values anymore. Well, that's one way to approach it. I'm typically not in favor of kind of banning stuff, but rather using them in the correct way. But I acknowledge that if you have a 100-year history of not using something correctly, maybe at some point you might end up just banning it. So, but that's maybe a little bit of a separate discussion. The other piece where this comes up is when statisticians approach me and say, I have this collaboration with commercial team, with the clinical team, and they have done a couple of analyses and then just emphasize a small p-value and assign a big importance to that p-value. How should I make them aware that maybe this is exaggerating the evidence that you have against some null hypothesis? I then try to first talk to the statistician and explain to them where these things come from. So we have these three concepts: confidence interval, hypothesis testing, and significance testing in the Fisherian sense, which means the p-value. And first, you need to kind of separate these things in your head and then try to go back to your stakeholder and try to make them aware that using the p-value in an inappropriate sense might exaggerate the evidence you have against a certain null hypothesis, if you want.
Let's first talk about the two schools there, Fisher and Neyman-Pearson, how they differently looked at hypothesis testing and the corresponding p-value. Can you explain the difference there?
Together with two colleagues from the University of Zurich, I wrote a book about 15 years ago. And there I co-authored the chapter about these concepts. And that made me look into the history of all this. And I guess, at least if you are my age, you also learned this at university still, but that's a long time ago. I think Fisher was in some sense first. And Fisher worked in an environment where it was not about making a decision immediately. You would run an experiment here, maybe in Roth-Hampstead, and you run another experiment somewhere else, and then you run yet another experiment, maybe later. And at some point, he wanted to kind of have some claim about, do I now have enough evidence to reject a certain null hypothesis? I think the aim was to combine evidence from multiple experiments. Mm-hmm. And one way of doing that is to say, I devise a quantity that is independent of the statistical test, independent of the sample size for each experiment. And then I combine these numbers over all experiments. And if this number at some point fulfills a certain criteria, I feel confident to say I have enough evidence against a certain null. And of course, that quantity is the p-value. The way of combining it is what we today call meta-analysis. So p-value combination. So that's one kind of school of thought. But this has never been intended to call something significant or to reject or to make an explicit decision. I think the spirit was more, science was understood as you accumulate evidence over time and at some point you have in some sense enough to be confident to say, okay, I think this is how things work. And then there was this other school, Nyman Pearson, developed a framework where you say, I have a null hypothesis. So that's kind of similar to Fisher. And I put an opposite of it, which I call the alternative hypothesis. And then I want to make an explicit decision for one or the other. Now, whenever you make an explicit decision, you run the risk of that decision being wrong. And what Nyman and Pearson said is, okay, let's quantify the risk of a wrong decision. And if the null hypothesis is true, I have the risk of still rejecting it based on variability. The probability of that happening is what we call the type one error. Or I have something that really works. So in some sense, the alternative is true, or maybe the null is not true. And I want to quantify the probability of then not deciding for H1. That's what we call the type two error. And this gives a framework for decision making. And if you remember how you learned about that at school or at university, typically, I think we are taught to construct a statistical hypothesis test and compute the test statistic and then derive the distribution of that test statistic, assuming the null hypothesis is true, and then compare the test statistics to quantiles of that distribution under the null. And either this test statistic is too large, then we reject the null, or it's not too large, then we don't reject the null. If you follow that procedure and you just do one test, and if all assumptions are true that you make, then this test has these operating characteristics, the pre-specified type one and type two error.
Yep.
That's all fine. If you keep it that way, that's all fine. And at the time, actually, Fisher and Nyman Pearson, I think that they had quite a heated debate. Others can tell more about which framework to use. But I think the challenge comes from, I think, two facts. Of course, in a hypothesis test in the Nyman-Pearson sense, we call rejection of the null statistically significant.
Yeah.
Now, Fisher called his test or his concept of p-values significance test. I mean, this doesn't really help. If you are not studying statistics and don't keep these things apart perfectly well, of course, that doesn't help. And the other challenge is that, of course, you can use the p-value to make a decision in a hypothesis test by just comparing it to the type one error that you assumed. If it's smaller, you reject the null. If it's larger, you don't reject the null. And I think that's where the confusion comes from, that these concepts are mixed.
Yeah. And then there's, of course, the other concept of that you just want to measure something. You want to measure an odds ratio, a risk difference, a hazard ratio, or whatsoever. Some kind of treatment effect, and you have a confidence interval around that. And of course, you can construct always with a confidence interval a significance test or a Nyman-Pearson test, yeah, just by checking whether the confidence interval includes or doesn't include the zero or the one, depending on do you have an absolute difference or a relative ratio. However, the primary goal of confidence intervals is not a test. It is to measure something and to get some kind of confidence. How often will this confidence interval actually overlap the true value? Yeah, we can, of course, now go even in the Bayesian way, where there we talk about prediction intervals, and there it's even you have a probability statement, which you, by the way, don't have in the confidence intervals. Yeah, that's another kind of little difference that I think it's very, very difficult to explain to non-statisticians.
Yeah, you bring up this third concept, and as you say, it has a completely different goal. The goal, I mean, you have this metaphysical population that you think you have drawn your sample from, and then you want to make a statement about a quantity in the population based on your sample. And the confidence interval seems to be a useful tool for doing that. But indeed, your interest is here not in refuting some hypothesis. It's just to say, what values of a population quantity are compatible with what I have seen in my data? And the confusion again comes from the fact that you can use a confidence interval in the way you described to make a decision in a hypothesis test. But the question is, should I do that? One area where this comes up in drug development sometimes is, I mean, you run clinical trials with primary endpoints, secondary endpoints, and sometimes we have quite complicated type one error protection strategies, and we shift around alphas for rejected hypotheses. And so this is about hypothesis testing. Which hypotheses can we reject? And then when you talk about the drug label, there is often, of course, the question, we also want to make inference about potentially the same quantities. Say your primary is a hazard ratio, and then you have response proportion differences. And so, how should I construct these confidence intervals? Should they, in some sense, reflect the type one error protection strategy you had for the hypothesis tests? Yes or no? And I mean, I think there are different schools of thought. My school of thought is, for me, the confidence intervals are independent of the hypothesis testing. A confidence interval is something that makes you learn something about a population parameter, and I don't care so much about a potentially underlying type one error protection strategy. And in my opinion, the confidence interval must not be able to repeat the hypothesis test decision. So these are different things in my mind, but I appreciate that people have different opinions about that. But think of for a non-statistician, it's already very difficult to interpret one confidence interval for one mean. How should a non-statistician interpret a confidence interval that accounts for a type one error strategy in your clinical trial? I think this is a very, very hard problem and a difficult ask.
Completely agree. Also, if you look into it from an evidence synthesis point of view, very often you will combine different studies into an overall evidence. And then Cochrane uses non-adjusted confidence intervals, of course. They would never have the idea that using an adjusted confidence interval. So they take the odds ratios, they take the variability that you have within the study and then combine it. Or the risk difference or the mean difference or whatever. One of the easy things is when you have a primary endpoint and you have everything pre-specified, or also for the, let's say, the secondary endpoints that you adjust for in your testing strategy, for these, calling them significant, statistically significant different, or not statistically significant different, that is more or less easy. I think the problem comes for all the other cases. And these are, of course, the majority of cases. Yeah. So let's imagine you have a secondary endpoint, a usual secondary endpoint, like a PRO that you also have included in your study. And you look into this. Or maybe you have another subpopulation, like you have want to look into all those patients that just with their, let's say, 10 or 20% of the population is excluded for whatever medical reason. And now you want to have a confidence interval there. Of course, most of the journals will then ask, oh, what's the p-value there? Yeah. You'll be very likely be pressed to present p-values. I think it will be very hard to get it published without p-values. Now, the question is, how do you put wording around these p-values? What would be your thought on that, Caspar?
Let's maybe start with an easy case. You have one hypothesis test. Say you run a clinical trial, you have a primary endpoint, you have one hypothesis test, and you do that, then you reject the null, and then you call this statistically significant. And this is how it's meant to be used. Statistical significance is a binary thing. Either it is statistically significant or it is not.
It's not highly statistically significant or whatever.
Yes, because for a hypothesis test in the Nyman-Pearson sense, you don't need a p-value. You just compare your test statistic against the suitable quantile under the null.
Mm-hmm.
Either it's larger, it's smaller, you are statistically significant, yes or no. Interpreted it like that, you're not even tempted to call it highly significant or what, because you can't, because you just check one number against the other and that's it. Now, with this habit of mixing hypothesis testing and the p-value, people are tempted to start calling things highly significant because the p-value is smaller than alpha and it is very small. But you cannot reject a null hypothesis more than reject.
Yeah.
It's a binary thing. So that is kind of one implication of that mixing of concepts. And I think this argument goes back to Stephen Senn. This then also relates to sometimes when people see, have a p-value of 0.06, if you are clear in a hypothesis test, and I mean, we have these clinical trials in drug development, it's not significant. You don't have a drug.
Yep.
End of story.
Yep.
Because it's a binary thing. But then people sometimes tend to start to think or talk about a trend to significance.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, these same people, that's the illustrative example that goes back to Stephen, I think. If these same people then have a p-value of 4%, would they call this a trend to non-significance? Of course not. This is then getting into the realm of misuse of concepts, in my opinion. So the p-value should not be used to qualify the level of evidence in a hypothesis test because you can't. It's a binary thing. Now, if you take the p-value as it was intended to be used, as kind of a continuous quantification of evidence against the null, then it's a fair question to ask, what is large evidence or not? And there is a paper by, I think, Pocock and colleagues, where they provide suggestions of labels. So they say if the p-value is above 0.1, then it's no evidence. If it's between 5 and 10%, they call it insufficient evidence. If it's between 1 and 5%, they call it some evidence. And if it's between 1 per mil and 1%, it's strong evidence, and everything below is overwhelming evidence. So, but again, this has nothing to do with statistical significance or hypothesis testing. It's just you label verbally how much evidence you have against the null. But it's not about type 1 error. It's not about type 2 error. It's not about statistical significance. If everybody would keep these concepts apart in this way, we would be fine. But of course, this is not what's happening. So this is the case of one hypothesis test. And then yet another complication is this issue of multiple testing. I mean, say you have 200 genes, you compare them between two groups, and you find 10 p-values which are below 5%. And then you end up writing a paper with these 10 genes in there.
Yeah.
That's not accurate. But if you say, I did compare 200 genes between these two groups and I found 10 p-values below 5%, and you write a paper about that, that's perfectly accurate. That's in, because then I know as a statistician, this is exactly what I would expect if there was no difference at all between the two groups for these 200 genes, because of course, 10 p-values below 5%, that's exactly what you would expect if there's no difference at all. And I think that is where things break. If people just report what they did, then everybody can do the multiple testing correction in their head. And then it also doesn't matter so much whether you report p-values or whatever, because then it's complete transparency about what you did. And that is also something that people underappreciate in drug development. I mean, why do we send in statistical analysis plans before we look at the data? Why do we remain blinded until data cutoff? This is one aspect is exactly this. You pre-specify, you say what you're going to do, you do it, either you succeed or you don't. And only then the hypothesis test that you run can be assumed to have the operating characteristics that you pre-specified, power and type 1 error. You still make assumptions about, or you still hope that all the assumptions you made hold true approximately. But only then is operator characteristics hold. And I think there is an underappreciation in other fields of that feature. I mean, the multiple testing issue there also, I mean, this is all, I didn't invent all this. Of course, it's just all available in the literature. There's a famous example where a group of researchers in the ICES2 trial submitted the trial to the Lancet, and the Lancet came back and said, we published this trial, but can you add, I don't know, a list of 100 subgroup analyses to that? And then the author said, well, we do that, but we just want to add one additional sub. And the Lancet said, well, that's fine. And then they added the zodiac sign. And of course, that immediately illustrated the difficulty in interpretation. And this is actually something I have been doing in the past as well. Kind of, if people go overboard with a multitude of analyses, not pre-specified, just kind of exploratory, and then cherry pick the ones they like, add something like the birth month or add something like the zodiac sign. And then if they see small p-values for two or three zodiac signs as well, maybe that makes them think.
Yep.
And maybe initially don't say it's the zodiac sign. Just say, I have here actually another subgroup. Look at these small p-values. Should I tell you what it is? And then, of course, they're very interested. And then it's, I don't know, Gemini and Libra or whatever. And then hopefully everybody understands that we should not go overboard. So this is kind of, these are two different problems. One is interpretation of hypothesis test in connection to p-value. And the other thing is multiple testing. But of course, I think they are related. And from somebody who maybe is not so deep into statistics, it's easy to confuse the two. But in theory, these are two different problems.
When it comes to subgroup analysis or subpopulations, I'm actually usually much more interested looking into the point estimates and the confidence intervals, because I want to see whether they are more or less in line, consistent. Do I see big changes? Yeah. Do I see quantitative or even qualitative interaction tests? Yeah, that is something that I'm interested in. So, for example, when we run a clinical trial and it is significant, however, there's, let's say, 5% of the patients that carry most of the safety, and you can clearly identify them, and you then get a label, not for all, but for the 95% that don't carry this, the safety burden. Then you can, of course, you want to run, okay, what are your estimates in this smaller population? And of course, when it's 5% by design, it will not be very largely different. Yeah. Still, you want to have a description of your benefit risk profile in these patients. Yeah. Maybe it's 10% or 20%. Yeah. So then, of course, it's interesting to see kind of from an estimation point of view whether you have similar effects. And of course, usually the, in most cases, the confidence intervals will get wider with fewer patients. And then, of course, a p-value that maybe was significant before becomes bigger than 6% afterwards, or bigger than 5% afterwards.
Yeah, so this is yet another topic that's prone to multiple testing, kind of subgroup analysis, for example, in clinical trials. And I think they may serve different purposes. And very often, the purpose is not really clarified up front. We just, as a habit, we show these forest plots. And if it's not clear up front, what are they supposed to be used for, then everybody can draw his or her own conclusions. I mean, let me mention two things here. There is literature quite well published and a little bit of a kind of a consensus how you should appraise if you have post-hoc subgroup findings. For example, has there ever been a biological rationale? Ideally, you specify a rationale if you suspect there is an effect in a subgroup. I mean, if you run a clinical trial, you analyze 20 subgroups, and nobody ever raised their hand and said, in this subgroup, I actually think there is something different. And then you find something. That just doesn't give it much credibility, because if this is so obvious that in this subgroup, something should be different, why has nobody raised it before?
Yeah.
I mean, the interaction test, which we know notoriously doesn't have a lot of power. There is literature that helps you interpret post-hoc subgroup findings. And the other thing I'd like to mention is just make a plug for a paper that we have that comes out soon in Statistical Methods in Medical Research, because what you were describing is exactly what we're actually interested in. You can think of, you have two extremes. One extreme, if you have a clinical trial and you have 20 subgroups, one extreme is to say, The overall estimate is also my best estimate in every subgroup.
Well, at least from a precision point of view.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. Then you have a very precise estimate in every subgroup, but the estimate might be biased. Yeah. The other extreme is when you say, and that's what we actually typically do, we look at every subgroup specific estimate. Then you have an unbiased estimate in every subgroup, but with potentially low precision because these subgroups yeah. tend to be small. These are two extremes. And now the question is, maybe we should interpolate between these two extremes yeah. and find something in between. And one way to do that is to think using kind of penalization methods. And that is the proposal we make, kind of borrow a little bit from other subgroups. If you have 19 subgroups that are completely homogeneous and you have just one outlier, then maybe you should pull that outlier to the others. And it is indeed an outlier. Yeah. But if you have things kind of all over the place, maybe you don't really have a homogeneous effect. I think you're right. This is then less about testing. It's more about, can we get an accurate estimate? Sometimes maybe you want to strike a different bias variance trade-off than looking at the one extreme of using the overall estimate in every subgroup or just looking at subgroup specific estimates. Maybe something in between is maybe more accurate. And actually, and that's what we show in the paper, if you do that, if you look at estimation efficiency, so the mean squared error, these interpolations actually can dramatically reduce the mean squared error, both compared to the overall estimate and to subgroup specific estimates. And I think that's where yep. hopefully at some point we should get at.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a perfect illustration. Now let's get to some kind of wordings that you could use in the discussion of such papers. I think we should shy away for subgroup analysis to talk about we have proven or we have shown. I would more kind of go towards sentences and verbs like the subgroups suggests, indicate, or something like that, rather than this kind of very, very strong verbs. What is your take on that?
We could even go further and just report what we have. I mean, I know. You run a trial or you do some analysis, you do some study, and then, of course, you have to discuss and qualify things. So I appreciate, I can understand the need to do that. There should at least be a very comprehensive factual description of what you have found. And then a discussion, of course, how should you qualify that? But yeah, there is a big push to exaggerate the findings. And it's interesting. I mean, we call a p-value below alpha typically statistically significant, which in many journals and in science at large may open the door to get something published, because this carries a lot of meaning when you have one pre-specified, pre-planned hypothesis test for which you run the study. But very often, this p-value smaller than 5% is not used in such a framework. And it's not without irony that in this POCOC paper, they call a p-value between 1 and 5% some evidence. So they are not terribly excited about the p-value between 1 and 5%. Yeah. The whole problem comes from the confusion with statistically significant. And then there is one aspect we didn't even discuss, which people often bring up as well, and I think which adds to the confusion. In English, significant means statistically significant and potentially also clinically significant. And of course, we all know this has yeah. nothing to do with each other a priori. Yeah. So a statistically significant effect must not at all be clinically meaningful. Of course, in the design of a clinical trial, and that's what I work a lot with teams, is you should design a clinical trial such that a statistically significant result is clinically meaningful. But there is a lot of confusion around this as well, because the effect we power at, say, you have a hazard ratio.
Yeah, it's yet another thing.
Yeah, that's yet another thing. That's even in the mind of many statisticians, these concepts are not so clear in my experience. So when you have 80% power to detect a hazard ratio of 0.75, if you get a p-value of 5%, you will not see an effect of 0.75. You will see something like 0.82.
Yeah.
This is the quantity you need to discuss with the clinical team. I don't care so much about the 0.75, whether that's clinically meaningful. I care whether 0.82 is clinically meaningful. Because if you end up with a trial that has a p-value of 5% and a point estimate of 0.82, and then everybody just shrugs with their shoulders and say, well, we thought we get 0.75. We will not change any practice because of something of 0.82. Then you have a statistically significant but clinically irrelevant result, and you want to avoid that. So that's yet another complication that people imply clinical relevance from statistical significance, which of course is independent.
I think the talking about clinical relevance is yet a completely different topic. Thanks so much. I think that was super helpful talking about these things and giving some kind of clarity to this. Kasper and I have agreed that we will record more of such episodes that go into a little bit the kind of day-to-day challenges that we all face. Because I know from many discussions that there's debate about it, there's, that is not kind of taught at universities, or there's not enough time. Also, getting that knowledge within the usual kind of day-to-day work is not that easy. So thanks a lot, Caspar, for this awesome discussion about p-values, hypothesis testing, estimation, and all the other things. Is there any final sentence that you want to have the listener go away with?
Thanks, Alexander, and I very much look forward to next episodes. Maybe one thing I mentioned, and I think I'm sometimes also critical of my own profession, but I encourage everybody or every statistician before you go back to clinicians or stakeholders and criticize them for not using the concepts appropriately, make sure you do your homework and understand the concepts yourself. And because that will enable you to have a better conversation, of course, with your stakeholders and make sure or at least attempt to have these concepts used properly.
Yeah, and make sure that all the different statisticians in your organizations speak with one voice. That's another thing, as that will help with credibility. Not that say, clinician says, yeah, but Fred, the other statistician, he was okay with that. Okay, thanks a lot. Otherwise, you get multiple testing by choosing the right statistician. That's definitely something that we want to avoid. Thanks a lot, Caspar. Have a great time. This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.